Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Friday, the 25th of January. The executive editor of Smithsonian Magazine is with us this hour, and the issue, this is going to be a fun hour. The Smithsonian staff got together to come up with a list of 28 places that the Smithsonian reader might wish to visit. And they divided these into different categories. Some are the portals into the past, where you can walk the timeless streets and byways of ancient cities on three continents. Also, feats of engineering. A matter of timing, choosing the right year, month, or even moment can make all the difference. Triumphs of vision, history's finest works of arts and design. Scale new heights. You can not only see nature's most spectacular sights, you can experience them. Also, encountering temples so magnificent they could only have been built by divine inspiration. And also looking at deteriorating or threatened destinations before they disappear. So we're going to talk about these places, and it should be great fun. Our guest this hour is Terry Monmany. Terry is the executive editor of Smithsonian Magazine. Perhaps you've been to see some of these places and would like to say, yeah, that should certainly be on the list, and perhaps you'd like to add some new places as well. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Kathleen.
Thank you so much for being with us. Well, this must have been great fun to have everybody get around the table and talk about these wonderful places in the world, huh?
Oh, we did. We did. We had a great time with it. It was headed up by our senior editor, Mark Strauss, and he recruited everybody to basically nominate three or four places, and we have maybe 30 people on the staff, and so we had a master list of about 90.
Oh, my.
And we had to sort of really hone it down, and we ended up with this crazy number of 28. I don't know how. I don't know if there's any kind of weird numerology to it, but there it is, 28 places around the world on all continents.
So as you were having these meetings, obviously not everybody in the staff has been to all of these places, but as you were talking about all of them, was there one that so seized your soul that you decided you'd go to a travel agent the next day and say, I want to see if I can go to this place?
Well, the place that I want most to go to on the list probably is Machu Picchu in Peru, the great Incan palace in deep in the mountains of Peru. And that would be probably my first stop if I could, and I could make the time and all that. And the place that probably delighted me the most when I read about it and surprised me in that sense is the Great Wall of China.
Really?
Yeah, because, you know, you hear about it.
Right,
and you've seen 100 pictures of it. Yeah. But when you really contemplate it and look at it and remember that it's, over 4,000 miles long and it was built from the 7th century over 1,000 years up till the 17th century, and it's just astonishing to contemplate. So that would be kind of a top 10 thing that you had heard about that suddenly learning more about might make you want to go to.
Actually, it's just fun to learn about all these places, even if you can't get to them, isn't it? You can always go to them in your imagination.
Yeah. Well, we're all armchair travelers these days at some degree. And, you know, one of the things that at Smithsonian Magazine we like to do is just introduce people to the world, open your eyes, and get us to think about what's happening around the world in some kind of meaningful way. And this is kind of a crash course in some of the world's great, most historic sites and places. And it makes for a kind of a sort of a photo album of world achievement in a funny way, if you think of it that way.
Let's talk a little bit more about Machu Picchu in Peru. It wasn't discovered all that long ago, was it?
Yeah, certainly not discovered by the West or what you would call, the developed world. It was, deep down there in the mountains of Peru, and it was constructed in the 15th century. So it's not as old as some other sites that we might talk about. It's 600 years old or so. But it was Hiram Bingham, who was a Yale historian, who discovered it, quote-unquote discovered it, in 1911, not that long ago. And Bingham was a great archaeologist and historian who in some ways has been considered the inspiration for Indiana Jones.
Hmm.
And
hmm.
He virtually stumbled upon it in the jungle, initiated some work there, wrote a book that became famous in its day, The Lost City of the Incas. And it's been sort of attracting visitors ever since.
Yeah. And what is it about the place? I mean, you look at pictures of it, and you would love to put yourself right there. It's just gorgeous.
Yeah, it's hard to get to. Yes, it is. You have to sort of go to the nearest cities, Cuzco or the others, and it's quite high up. It's thousands of feet up. So it takes a day or two, they say, to even acclimate before you sort of make the final trek up to this magnificent palace that's 600 years old and crumbling. So it's one of those rare combinations of remote adventure nature experience combined with a kind of a lost civilization feeling, I think, that makes it very special.
Now, this is in the category of a matter of timing. Choosing the right year, month, or even moment can make all the difference. Why is it in that category?
Well, I think in this case it was because there are people who, veterans of visiting Machu Picchu, have strong ideas about when to go, both in terms of the time of year, which isn't that important, but especially the time of day. So there are ways to approach Machu Picchu sort of leaving before dawn so that you arrive as the sun is coming up over the Great Palace in the mountains, and it's said to be a great mystical experience.
Mm-hmm. And the other places that are in that category, a matter of timing, the Serengeti?
Yeah, the Serengeti, of course, the great swath of nature in Africa, touching in Tanzania and Kenya. There are different times of the year that you might want to go there to see the wildlife, depending on where they are in their migratory patterns. So sometimes people like to go in September and October to see some of the wildebeest, migrating. Mm-hmm. And then other times people like to go in January and March, which is when the calving season is going on. So that is a kind of a seasonal question.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are times of the year, April and May, when the rains are very heavy and you might not want to go.
We've gone to Minnesota for a few years now, and I got to tell you, about 11 o'clock at night, we take this little boat out in the middle of this gorgeous lake and look for Aurora Borealis. I don't know if we've ever really seen it or not, but I sure would like to see it in all its glory somewhere, sometime. Where do we go?
Well, you're right, I think, to point out that you can see it even from the continental United States at times, especially in the winter. If you really want to get up and close and personal with the fabulous Aurora Borealis, it's recommended that you go sort of north of 60 degrees latitude, which would put you into Alaska north of the Yukon. And that would be where you'd want to be. And they say the best time is around the fall and spring equinoxes, when the sort of solar storms are the most active and create the most light in the sky at night.
We just didn't go far enough to find them. That must be quite a sight from there, though, huh?
Oh, boy. I would love to see that, too.
I would, too. I know.
And the trick is to stay warm, I think.
Right. Well, down here.
Yeah.
Right. We don't have to worry about that.
Yeah.
Feats of engineering. Are many of these quite old?
Yes, they are. Most of them are. The ones that we're looking at in this category, which is sort of about places that you're surprised, kind of people of ancient times or old times managed to build. You know, we all have this crazy bias that the best and most sophisticated structures in the world are new ones, but of course there was fabulous architecture and monuments that were created centuries and even millennia ago. So among the ones that we've picked as feats of engineering, of course the pyramids at Giza are the oldest, and they're probably the oldest site in our collection of 28 places to see. And they're close to 4,500 years old.
Goodness.
So they dwarf by a couple thousand years almost anything else that we're looking at.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to see those as well.
Yeah, me too. We have to stop working so hard at our desks and get out into the world a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's probably there's also a time of life to do a good chunk of this, I would think. I did a lot of traveling before I had to settle down and figure out what I was going to do. And I think that a lot of younger people these days don't have that luxury, that we kind of moved in and out of jobs. And now you got to be more prepared. So I had the luxury of travel a lot when I was in my 20s. It was great.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point, and I wonder to what extent young people that is getting right out of college or high school at that time in their lives feel free to travel, or young Americans anyway.
Mm-hmm.
We're always accused, Americans, of being among the least traveled people compared to our friends in Australia and Europe and even Eastern Europe and Russia, and Asia. Maybe this will prod us a little bit to sort of get up and get out.
Right. And what about these places you put in here today, gone tomorrow, the Venice, the Amazon, the Great Barrier Reef, the Galapagos Islands? Is there great fear that they won't be here much longer?
Well, these are all places that are eminently visitable today and worth a visit, and I think would provide a satisfying visit. But they're all places that have a little bit of a question mark, too, because of various reasons. In the case of Venice, which was described as one of the most beautiful streets in the world 500 years ago, the city is just built amid the sea on a bunch of islands, and they're sinking for geological reasons. And then people know that this has been going on for a while, and they sink. Oh, I don't know, a couple inches every decade. And that's a concern to Venetians for decades. And a number of restoration projects are under work to try to sort of shore up some of these fabulous buildings. But, there is concern that maybe down the road it's going to be hard to enjoy the Venice that we know of today. And likewise, some of these other places, the Great Barrier Reef off Australia, where, they're, it's 1,200 miles long, but all the coral reefs in the world right now are considered somewhat at risk because of global warming and pollution and things like that, which are damaging to coral. These organisms are very, very sensitive. So there are different things going on in the world that put pressure on certain sites, as we all know too well. And some of those sites on our list are among the places in the world that are feeling that pressure, whether it's tourism or pollution or just the wear and tear of time.
Is it hard to get to the Amazon rainforest?
That's a good question.
I would think that it's really hard to get there.
That's a good question. I haven't been there. I suspect it all depends on what you mean by hard. Most people seem to go to the western reaches of the Amazon. Even in Peru, we tend to think of Brazil as being the home of the Amazon, and most of it is there. But some people approach it from Peru, the Amazon basin, because the least spoiled and least sort of damaged parts of the Amazon tend to be there. But if I were going to the Amazon tomorrow, I don't know how I would get there, frankly.
Right.
I would have to call up somebody who specializes in that kind of travel.
Yeah.
And we here at Smithsonian, really we're trying to call attention to wonderful places, virtually all of which you have heard of before. So we're not breaking any ground here.
Right.
But we were just trying to kind of a gentle, friendly reminder and a little bit of an update on these places, and we really are counting on our brilliant readers and listeners to find their way to these places.
Right. Well, let's invite our brilliant listeners to join the conversation. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. Or if you'd like to send an email, you could do that as well. That address is talk@wpr.org. Terry Monmany is our guest, executive editor of Smithsonian Magazine, and they have put together in this month's issue a wonderful description of places and a list of places, the Smithsonian Life List, traveling the globe in search of destinations that are certain to expire. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Monday during this hour at 10 o'clock, we'll be talking about, well, we'll ask this question, when did kids stop playing outside and what is it doing to them? So that's coming up Monday at this time. To your phone calls now. And your emails if you want to send them as well. That is talk@wpr.org. Our number is 800-486-8655. And the executive editor of Smithsonian Magazine is our guest, Carolyn from Oconomowoc. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Great. My husband and I just came back from a trip to Machu Picchu and the Galapagos Islands.
Oh, my gosh. Two of them are on the list.
Yep. We were there in November. We had great weather. And Machu Picchu really isn't that difficult. Both my husband and I are 65. And we were with a group from the University of Wisconsin alumni group.
Oh.
And you take a train. Well, you can walk into Machu Picchu on a four-day trip. You can do it on a two-day trip. And you can do it on a six-hour trip. Or you can do it the way we did it, which is a train all the way up there.
Oh, my.
They have a train. And then, yes, the air is a little bit difficult for breathing, but there, if you take your time, you can climb that with it really out without too much difficulty because you have to stop and look around always. Mm. I mean, it is just so awesome.
Mm.
And you also have to watch your step when you're climbing. So, you know, you take some, you climb a little bit, and then you stop and you watch and you look out.
Mm.
We had a wonderful guide. I would recommend that anybody that do that have a guide with them, because and we saw groups that didn't, and I think you miss a lot if you don't.
Right.
But it really wasn't that difficult.
Mm. Why did
well, that's great to hear. Great to hear.
Are you jealous?
I am.
I know,
I'm really
I bet.
Jealous. And yeah. I'm reminded that the trips that I were looking at, I literally was looking at it, and I looked into it a little bit. I was going to go and do a sort of a camping, hiking trip.
Right.
And that, that might have been where I got the idea that it was a mm-hmm. bit more of a rigorous.
And I think it would probably mm-hmm. be pretty awesome to do that because you come up over the top of it when you've the trail goes over the top of it, so when you come around the bend of people who are hiking, you see it all below you.
Mm.
And
yeah.
that must be really awesome. But it was awesome for us to do it the way we did it and was within our capability.
Yeah, well, lucky you.
Yeah, lucky
and
is right.
Higher, actually, than Machu Picchu. So you're in Cusco for a while, and that's actually at a much higher elevation.
Mm.
Machu Picchu is lower.
How about the Galapagos? How were
oh
they?
Oh, my God.
Oh, they were great.
Oh, you know, I just can't even tell you, because the wildlife is so, so in a sense, protected. They don't see humans as predators, so you can get so close to them. And they do have paths, so you can't get into nesting areas or things like that. And the people of Ecuador take very much pride in the Galapagos Islands, and they protect them. I mean, we took a little dinghy out to pick up some trash that they saw in the ocean there.
Hmm.
There's
right.
no litter. There is not. There is no litter. There is nothing that you know. I mean, obviously, and every boat that goes in there is small. They only allow smaller ships through that area.
Mm-hmm.
So there was I think 25 in our group to Galapagos and 9 to Machu Picchu.
Oh my.
With a small group, but it was wonderful.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Thank you,
well,
Carolyn.
Awesome. Okay.
Yeah, thanks. Well, you're
right. Well, you can't beat experience, you know?
Right. Really, people give those kinds of descriptions of places, and it does make you want to go, right?
Well, part of the fun of this of doing this, and we knew we were sticking our neck out, was, you know, you generate a list, and of course everybody has ideas about what should be on the list or what isn't on the list, and there's a great raging debate about online, even at our website, smithsonian.com, about, well, why did you not mention, you know, the Hermitage in St. Petersburg or why didn't you mention, Mount McKinley? Or, you know, there's a wonderful sort of discussion that this generates and is meant to generate. This isn't meant to be the end-all and be-all.
Right. There wouldn't only be 28 places. The world's a big place, right?
Right, yeah. So it's fun.
Thanks, Carolyn. Let's go next to Willie. Hi, Willie.
Hi, how are you today? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I was just going to bring up that there's a couple places in Germany that I really enjoyed when I went over there back in 98. One of them, I believe they called it, I don't speak German, so I guess I don't know if I'll pronounce it right, but it's, I think it's Siebengebirge, the Seven Hills. And it's right along the Rhine River. And I took a five-hour bike tour along the Rhine River, and it was just amazing because they have old castles and lots of just old town, you know, old, like, German buildings and just beautiful scenery along there. And I think it was one of my favorite parts of my trip down there.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds great.
Thank you, Willie. Thanks so much for your call. And let's go to Mike from Eau Claire. Hi, Mike.
Hi there.
Hi.
Just two comments. First of all, I have not been to those places yet, but the Travel Channel did a very nice 30-minute show on Machu Picchu last week, and that host took the train right up as the other caller was describing, and it was really very nice and looked like a good place to go. I wanted to comment on a different place, though. Quite a few years ago, my wife and I traveled to Europe, and we went to a place in Italy called Ostia Antica, which is an ancient Roman ruin east of Rome on the Mediterranean. And there are mosaics, you know, that date to B.C. I don't exactly know how old. And Roman theaters and ruins, you know, it's just fascinating. It was a trading center before the time of Christ, and there are just amazing works of, like, mosaic art and buildings left that they had done that time. And so just wanted to tell you about that.
Well, that's a good tip. Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, thanks so much for the call. You could do another list. Maybe you're doing this in the magazine. You'll certainly do it in letters to the editor of all the suggestions that you get. I'm sure this is going to spark some digging on your part to look at even more places, right?
Yes, yes. I hope this becomes kind of an ongoing discussion about places to go. Because, you know, what's more fun than sitting around debating the virtues of one side or another?
Right.
You know, it's a good time, especially, you know, in the middle of the winter, right?
You got it. What's more fun? I'm having fun right now, that's for sure. What about these places? I guess I have been to Pompeii, but I really like going to these ancient cities because you wonder how people had all this knowledge that we're relearning, I think, many, many centuries later. Mesa Verde, Pompeii, Tikal, there are others on the list. Can you talk about them some?
Sure, love to. Well, one of my favorites is Petra, you know, in Jordan, which was built by an Arab tribe, the Nabataeans, in the first century B.C. And it's this tremendous kind of valley that was carved out of the soft red rock in that area. And when you look at the pictures of it, it's just astonishing because they essentially built the city by carving it out of the cliffs that were already there. So that really makes you marvel at the amazing ability of these peoples, 2,000 years ago, who didn't have, of course, power drills or tungsten, saws and all the things that we use today. So it's always a bit humbling to be reminded, I think, of how ingenious people were even thousands of years ago. And Tikal is another example of that, you know, 200 years B.C. in Guatemala, the Yucatan Peninsula, the Mayans, you know, that great towering city of monuments and pyramids. Never fail to inspire awe when people visit them. So, you know, it's just. And then in this country, one of the sites that we picked is Mesa Verde in southwestern Colorado, which is now the site of a national park. And these were the ancestral Pueblo people who built these astonishing structures in the cliffs there in southwestern Colorado and thrived there. For 800 years ago, and even in this country. So we have places that inspire that kind of awe.
Mm-hmm. And why did they leave? Do you know?
Well, there's a great debate among anthropologists over that, but it's felt that it was a combination of, over a course of several centuries, they essentially deforested their immediate area and largely wiped out the various large game that they had been subsisting on, as well as some other things. And then on top of that, they were hit by a terrible drought that lasted a couple of decades. And so the feeling was that they just drifted out of that area, perhaps in search of water.
Let's go to Greg from – thank you very much for your call, Mike. And let's go to Greg from Madison. Hi, Greg. Hi, Greg. Are you there? No, Greg. So we'll go to Joe from Racine. Hi, Joe.
Oh, good morning.
Hi.
I've been to some of the places you're talking about, and they are inspiring. But I've also been to the Parthenon and the Pantheon, and I think you should include Angkor Wat.
And we do. We do. Angkor Wat is in our list, and so is the Parthenon. Not the Pantheon, and some people have written in to us to ask why we did not include the Pantheon, and I can't tell you, but we didn't. But I think Angkor Wat is a great idea, and we do have a little bit about that, and the Parthenon as well.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the Parthenon is the, a little tip to your readers, the Parthenon is the cover story of our next issue of Smithsonian.
Oh, great. And these are temples, you say, so magnificent that they could only have been built by divine inspiration.
And we all know we're not supposed to talk about politics or religion. So these were all, you know, various kinds of inspiration, I think. And that's a sort of fascinating lesson to take away from that as well.
Mm-hmm. Carolyn Milwaukee writes, I'm wondering what the impact of tourism is on the more fragile locations that are being discussed.
Well, that's a terrific question. And as, you know, standards of living rise around the world, you know, we do see a lot of tourism at places that may, you know, may be affected by that. The Galapagos is one area that people are very concerned about, the impact of tourism. And as your caller pointed out, they're very careful, the Ecuadorians who run the place, are very careful about trying to limit and restrict visitors. But, you know, visitors have, the number of visitors to the Galapagos have more than tripled in the past 15 years.
Ooh.
And so now about 150,000 people are visiting there every year. And over time, they accidentally introduce different kinds of species. And as we know, the whole beauty of the Galapagos is that it is this astonishing biological archipelago. So people are concerned about that. And in a more indirect way, of course, global warming may have some effect on some of these sites like Kilimanjaro, where the glaciers atop Kilimanjaro are said to be melting a little bit. So there are various ways in which human impact can, you know, detract from the these sites.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Joe, for your call. Let's go to Ben next from Verona. Hi, Ben.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Say, I know you guys were talking earlier about the Northern Lights, and I lived up in Alaska for 13 years. And if you want to see something spectacular, that's where to go.
Mm.
They're just incredible. They look like waves, basically, when they really get going up there. And I've actually heard them crackle. I drove semi up there, and I drove all over the state, above the Arctic Circle.
Mm.
I used to go up to Prudhoe Bay quite often. And up there, with away from the city lights, it's just, I mean, they actually fill up the whole sky up there.
Oh, yeah, I bet.
It's really something to see up there. If you ever, too, if you get a chance, too, the Dalton Highway, which is called the Hall Road, it's from Fairbanks, 475 miles of gravel road from Fairbanks all the way up to Prudhoe Bay, and it follows along the pipeline, and it's probably the most remote place in the United States. It's so remote back in those days they never would allow the general public to travel it, but they were starting to open it up to permits for people to go up, tourists and stuff, when I left there back in 92, And that's an incredible place to see the Northern Lights. Also, the moon. It's incredible. The moon looks like it's just huge up in the sky. I don't know why it is that way. Maybe it's just the Earth's closer, I think, the way it's tilted or something. But anyway, I thought I'd share that with you. Even in Anchorage, you can see the Northern Lights, even with the city lights, you can see the Northern Lights really, really well up there, too, when they're... And most of the times I saw them, I always remembered being in the wintertime, you know, right about now, February, January, so...
Anyway, right, I think that's what Terry was saying. Thank you. Thanks so much for the call.
You bet.
Yeah. Well, he was in the right spot, wasn't he, Terry?
Yeah, those are good. Those are good tips. And boy, I'd love to get up to those more remote parts of Alaska myself. I mean, that's just amazing to spend time up there. And you know, he points out about the lights and how bright the moon is. We forget how, even if we're living in suburban or rural areas, the sky at night is affected by all the various lights nearby, and to get out way away from that is really to commune with nature in a way that we don't often get to do.
Yeah, and we almost need to do, don't we? I don't know how to describe it, but it really does the body good to be able to do that at least once a year.
Oh, my goodness, once a year, yes. I would hope once a week would be nice.
Right.
Yeah.
Doesn't happen, though, does it?
Exactly.
Yeah. Thanks, Ben, so much for your call. Kathy is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm calling today just to say that I'm really excited that I turned the radio on, and here was this great show with the Smithsonian involvement. I'm lucky enough, I should say, that I'm going to be going on a trip soon to Greece, and it is with a particular travel group, but it's a Smithsonian Journey Travel Adventure.
Oh, great.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, and I'm not very well traveled, but this one just intrigued me, and I'm hoping that it will be very, very educational because of the involvement of the Smithsonian.
Yes. Well, good luck with that. I hope you have a great time. And I think your caller is referring to this department of the Smithsonian called Smithsonian Journeys, where they set up these quite elaborate tours of different parts of the world, and usually bring along some kinds of experts to explain what it is that you're visiting and seeing, and it's quite an involved thing. And most people have a terrific time.
Oh, I'm sure they do.
I'm intending on doing that, and I should mention that the great part is that this is a senior group that is going, and I'm lucky enough insofar as my mother puts together these wonderful trips a couple of times a year through the Whitefish Bay Recreation Department right outside of Milwaukee. And it's always a fabulous trip, a wonderful group of people. And I just am so pleased that I can be involved. So,
oh, have a good time, Kathy. You will, I know.
I know, and thank you so much for all of the great information today.
Thank you. Thanks for the call.
You're welcome.
Isn't it great when people turn the radio on and they find this connection, you know, it's like they were supposed to turn the radio on.
Well, I'm with you. I'm deeply, deeply into the radio. I just think it's great for that reason.
Yeah, I do too. Thanks, Kathy. Have a wonderful journey. Let us go to Andy from, where are you from, Andy?
Grand Junction, Colorado.
Oh, you're from Colorado.
Well, I'm from Green Bay, but I'm living in Colorado for the winter.
Oh. All right, yeah. Andy. Well, I'm glad you found us. Go right ahead.
Listen all the time. I've traveled a bit, been to the Louvre, been to Ireland and that, but I love America's national parks, and between America and Canada, United States and Canada, I've been to at least 30, but my favorite by far is Arches National Park, in, which is really close to where I am right now, in Utah.
Yeah.
And you're talking about a divine inspiration before, and I tell you, you don't have to be religious, but you sure do get a feeling of divine inspiration when you come up to that delicate arch in Arch National Park. It just blows you away. When you come around that corner, it's something to watch all the people when they first see it. You can just sit there and watch them, and their expressions on their faces are just like, wow. And like you say, you don't have to believe in a religion, but you sure do feel like you have a religious experience the first time you see that sucker. It's pretty neat.
Terrific.
Definitely encourage anybody to go there and see it. It's not too far away from anywhere in the United States, really.
Yes, so no, you're right. Cool. And there are wonderful sites in the United States that we could concentrate on. And that's a really good point. And the national parks are a treasure for that reason. The one, the other national park in our list of 28 is the Grand Canyon.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about that in a slightly different way, not so much going to the South Rim and looking down into it, but hiking down into it and through it, and which is meant to be a fantastic, very intense experience that takes a couple of days.
I hiked down quite a bit of it, but hiking back up was really hard. Oh, my gosh, it was hard.
Yeah, I bet.
But that's quite a sight, too. There are some sights in the world that you look at them and you're just dumbfounded by them, aren't you? You can't believe they exist.
Yeah, that's true. And no matter how many times you've seen it in a book or, God forbid, a magazine like Smithsonian, you know, it's another thing to stand on the rim of the Grand Canyon. There's no way that a little picture can give you that feeling. And you know, hey, as often as we might sometimes be disappointed by things going on in the world, there's still an awful lot of fantastic things to do and see.
Yeah, point well taken. All right, let's pause for a moment. We'll return and take more of your phone calls. Terry Monmany is our guest, executive editor of Smithsonian Magazine. And if you go to this month's issue, they have a list of 28 places, global destinations, that that are part of a life list, destinations that are certain to inspire. I'm Kathleen Dunn. More phone calls in a moment. And you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to phone calls for Terry and thank Andy for calling us from Colorado today. We take a call from Brian from Oshkosh next. Hi, Brian.
Hello, Kathleen. Hi, Terry. Great topic today.
Hi, Brian.
I just wanted to call and talk about the wife and I went down to Guatemala just this last fall.
Oh.
And, oh, it's beautiful. Saw Antigua, Flores, and went to Tikal.
Oh.
There you are.
And, oh, what a beautiful place.
How was it? Was it crowded, Brian?
No, not at all. Not where we were. We had a guide with a small tour group, maybe six of us total in the group, and he took us around to the temples. But to be able to climb those temples and look above the rainforest and see other temples just poking out of the rainforest like that was just it was an awe.
Hmm.
It was beautiful. And just to be able to climb these things that are, you know, thousands of years old, it was rather impressive.
And what surprised you most about the experience?
Well, the age and the construction of these massive temples just out in the rainforest and the civilization that had been there before.
Yeah.
We kind of did it as a heritage tour. We adopted my son from down there, so we wanted to see his Mayan heritage, where he came from, and his people before. It was just the building of this massive city, because it just spreads throughout the rainforest. And I'm not even sure if they have 10 or 15% of it, you know, uncovered as of yet. And it was just truly impressive. And
yeah, that's true.
Flores,
as much as we talk about these places as if they are entirely kind of available, work by archaeologists and historians continues at many of these places, and they're still discovering them.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. They were doing digs and archaeological stuff while we were there. We could see different, you know, people. I believe Pennsylvania is one of the main universities that's working down there at this moment, you know, doing some of the digs and whatnot. And just to be able to climb these structures, they're so impressively old. It was quite an experience. The wife and I really enjoyed it.
I'm sure. And then to have your son have roots there as well really adds to it. It's kind of heartening to think, Terry, that everything has not yet been discovered, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, the world isn't getting any bigger, So it's nice to know as we elbow our way through the crowds every day that there are still some frontiers left sites attract scholars and archaeologists of various kinds to and who are still hard at work trying to figure out how they were built, who built them, why, what do they mean, and that itself is a kind of frontier, isn't it, when you think about trying to understand something that poses a mystery. And they still are, you know, aren't entirely sure how the Polynesian people who lived on Easter Island were able to move those enormous 15-ton statues that they carved out of the volcanic rock, right? And Easter Island is another of our 28 places to see before you die.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're still experimenting on that. So this is something that some ancient or, you know, people knew how to do 600 years ago that we today don't know how they did it.
Right.
That's kind of fun.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it sure is. It sure is fun.
And anybody can go and give it a shot.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Thanks, Brian, so much for your call. Barbara is next from Madison. Hi, Barbara.
Good morning. And thank you both for giving me this chance to reminisce about all these places in the world we visited. It just brings it very clearly into my mind's eye. And I got to thinking about our beautiful state of Wisconsin. And geologists from all over the world come and visit our Baraboo Hills and the Devil's Lake area. It really is a divine experience to go there at any time of the year, any time of the day. And it is such a special place. And I think that sometimes we neglect to think about those places that are so dear to us, that are so available to
right.
us. And I'm inviting people from all over the world to come and visit us, the Baraboo Hills. And they do. People, geologists, do come and are very interested in the Baraboo Hills. So come to Wisconsin.
Did she sell you, Terry?
That's a good tip.
It is a beautiful state. There are a lot of little places in northern Wisconsin that I've found along rivers that, with all this beautiful wildlife, and I go back to them every year. They're just little places that you find when you're driving along dirt roads, and you find these little beauties. It's
oh, sure, yeah.
yeah.
Wisconsin is magnificent. The rolling hills and the lake country, and it is wonderful. But I think your caller makes a terrific point that there are inspiring and astonishing places, oftentimes not too far away. And
right.
probably one of the greatest trips I personally ever made in the United States was along the coast of Washington and the great national park out there, the Olympic Peninsula. And it's just an amazing place. And I argued with our editors here that to include it on the list, and I didn't win.
Terry.
Even though I'm the executive editor, I lost out. So we can all get worked up about our favorite places, and luckily here in the United States, we have lots of them to think about.
Yeah, we sure do. Well, after all, you are the executive editor, so why not at least a piece on the Olympic Peninsula, right?
Yeah.
You could do that.
It's kind of a question of threshold, you know. I mean, when we say 28 places to see before you die, we're assuming that you've seen a lot of places already. We don't need to tell you to come see the Lincoln Memorial, for example.
Right.
We don't need to tell you to go see the Golden Gate Bridge or a lot of places that we all look forward to visiting. We tried to pick those places that are kind of truly world attractions for one reason or another.
Yeah. Let's go next to thanks, Barbara, for your call. A couple lines are open for the first time if you want to join us. 800-486-8655 or 227-2050 in Milwaukee. Rod from Milwaukee. Hi.
Yes, hi. I am certainly struck by the point that we go to these places and discover that ancient people, certainly what we think of as pre-technological people, are able to do remarkable feats of engineering.
Absolutely.
I think related to that is the discovery that people of all different races, all different colors, are remarkable people. My wife and I have done a fair amount of traveling since we've been retired. We're in our 70s now, And we just got back from Africa, where our whole time was spent, or most of the time was spent, with very dark black people who were incredibly knowledgeable and intelligent and helpful. We've been in environments of what I'll describe as short, dark, brown people, Asian people, and on and on. And in all cases, we have found great intelligence, great hospitality, common elements of human nature that I think when we sit at home, we tend to think white people, 21st century white men, are the ultimate of evolution, and travel is something that really puts the lie to that notion. Help.
Do you want to respond, Terry?
Do I want to respond? Skin color is never really a sort of a criterion of intelligence or advancement or anything like that. So I certainly agree with the spirit of what the caller is saying, and that's not. That's about it.
All right, thanks, Rod, for the call. Eugene from Viola. Hi.
Good morning, Kathleen. I live in the western part of Wisconsin, little village of Viola, and this beautiful Kickapoo Valley is just plain gorgeous. It starts up at Wilton, and the Kickapoo River empties into the Wisconsin down at Waseca. And from this hill country, from the last 2 weeks in May until the first 2 weeks in June, is just gorgeous. When I was a child growing up here, from Viola north to the little village of Ontario, Wisconsin, it's 18 miles. And you crossed the Kickapoo River 15 times. There were just 15 bridges. And from Viola to Lafarge, the old Highway 131 winds in against the bluffs, and you're looking down at the valley below you. And then just before you get to Lafarge, you drop down into the valley, and you're looking at the rock formations and the hills around you. And it is just plain beautiful. Then above Lafarge, there's 8,500 acres, the Kickapoo Valley Reserve, that they use for camping, that belongs to the state of Wisconsin now, I think. And it's just, this is just plain beautiful area.
I know. Well, it.
Glad to hear it.
Yeah. And it's nice to have people extol the virtues of beautiful areas where they live, to appreciate the wonder and the beauty of the area that's right outside. That's good.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Eugene, so much for your call. All right, let's go to Gene from Big Bend. Hi, Gene.
Gene is good morning.
Hi, Gene.
To thank the Smithsonian for these fine items. We really appreciated all of them. My wife and I have been able to be 12 of these places, and it's exciting to refresh our memories.
Hmm.
I would like to say that I did see the Aurora Borealis probably better than any one time on a flight from from Washington to Milwaukee in 1975.
Oh, my.
And the altitudes we were flying, they were really spectacular. And we even got a bonus because Milwaukee was socked in, and we had to go on to Madison. So we had a few more minutes to view the aurora.
Ah, good. It's a good reason to get a window seat at night, isn't it?
I hadn't thought of that. I'll remember that next time, Terry. Thanks, Gene, for the call. Marilyn from Washburn. Hi.
Good morning. Again, thank you for the call. I was calling mainly to encourage people to just go. You know, I hear the wistful notes in your voices, and having read National Geographic as a child, I wanted to go to Egypt. And by heaven, it took me a long time, but I got there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was spectacular. I'm just encouraging people to just do it. Because there are too many good reasons not to do something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And whether it's the Kickapoo or this gorgeous south shore of Lake Superior where I live, just up and go.
Hmm.
and you'll be so happy, and you'll be amazed how things work themselves out.
All right, Terry, there's your encouragement. Just go.
I know. I've got to unchain myself from my desk, I guess, is what I'm being told.
Well, it's hard sometimes.
That's great advice.
Yeah, but you do need to carve out that time whenever, or take every 5 years and go for a long trip somewhere.
Well, you know, Americans, and I think there are studies that bear this out, are not famous for taking long vacations.
Right.
And there are, in fact, advocacy groups that are trying to encourage Americans to take longer vacations. So I think that that's a great point, that people do need to take some time out and refresh those other parts of their brain or their soul or their spirit by seeing the world a little bit.
Yeah. Terry, thank you so much. You were a wonderful guest. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, my pleasure, Kathleen. I had a lot of fun, and thank you.
Entirely welcome. Terry Monmany, our guest. He is the executive editor of Smithsonian Magazine, and they have – you can go to the web for this as well, Smithsonian Magazine. The Smithsonian Life List is what we were talking about. It's in the January 2008 issue of Smithsonian Magazine. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for production – on-air production here in Milwaukee, and for all of your calls as well. We have news coming up and then many more hours of interesting conversation ahead. Have a lovely weekend. I'll be with you again Monday at 9. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.